Elton Bourne edits the news. Tonight, Columbia's veteran news analyst speaks to you from the studios of WJR in Detroit to bring you his usual keen analysis of the day's news. Mr. Kaltenborn.
And good evening, everybody. And in order that I may not overrun my time, may I ask this friendly announcer of station WJR to click my stopwatch 1 minute before he wants me off the air. The sort of strike that seems useless and needless to most observers is now on here in Detroit. 55,000 automobile workers have been idle for 8 days at a time when the demand for new cars is steadily rising all over the United States. I've talked to almost everyone I've met here in Detroit about the strike, and no one seems to know just what it is about or why it was necessary. Some tell me the Chrysler company tried to speed up the assembly line too much. And then the men, acting under the direction of the CIO, started a slowdown strike, and then the company closed the plants. Now, some Detroiters tell me that the CIO unions are always making trouble. If they don't pull a strike ever so often, they can't collect dues, is the way they put it. Others say that the company is trying to make the men work too hard and too fast. The whole thing hinges on production standards. What rate of speed is fair for an assembly line? Why can't that question be answered by negotiations instead of by a strike? Robert W. Conder, director of Chrysler Labor Relations, is quoted in tonight's Detroit News as saying, Chrysler officials believe, quote, that production schedules are the function of management, end quote. But the company admits by its actions that they are also subject to discussion with workers, since it is now discussing them with the workers. Only it's discussing them after the strike has begun instead of discussing them before the strike began. Now, Mr. Conder said today there seems to be a better spirit of cooperation on the part of the union. And Richard T. Frankenstein, the UAW CIO director, said, we want our people working and realize that the corporation is losing a lot of sales. Well, the outsider can't help wondering why intelligent industrialists and equally intelligent union leaders can't work out a plan by which speed-ups and slowdowns can both be avoided until and unless there has first been at least an attempt to come to an agreement. In Washington today, a charge of filibustering was directed at those who oppose repeal of the United States arms embargo in the Senate late today. Now, this is only the third week of the neutrality debate, and one wonders what kind of a definition of filibustering is given by those who make that charge. Now, there may not perhaps be an exact scientific division of just when a debate ceases to be a debate and begins to be a filibuster. But the understanding that I gathered from talking with various senators just before the debate began was that so long as the debate actually centered on a discussion of the problems involved, that so long it could not be called a filibuster. And to my mind, that's a perfectly sound definition. After all, this is a tremendously important issue. There are 96 senators, and there are only so many hours in the day for those senators to talk. They haven't all talked. In fact, I don't believe more than half of them have talked so far. So, I wonder just what the charge of filibustering involves. It came today after efforts by Majority Leader Barkley to obtain the opposition's consent to limit general debate. Well, the opposition perhaps feels that it isn't ready yet to limit general debate. Some people call the elimination of debate dictatorship. And the filibuster, of course, when it actually develops, is sometimes an effort to prevent dictation by a majority. Of course, if a filibuster succeeds, then it's dictation by a minority. So you can have it either way. But on the whole, the impression that the country has had of this debate is that thus far it has confined itself to the issues, and that therefore the charge of filibustering seems to come a little early. Now, of course, it's true the indications are the administration will get at least 2 out of every 3 votes that are cast on the bill. Repeal, as matters stand, of the embargo is practically assured. The various concessions which the administration has made, and it has made enormous concessions on its original ideas, they've all helped to win more votes for it. But why not continue the debate so long as outstanding senators who have not yet spoken feel that they would like to speak upon this tremendously important issue. The U-boat raid on Sunday on Scapa Flow in the Orkney Islands turns out to be the boldest and perhaps the most ingenious, outstanding exploit of the war. I have before me here the text of Captain Preen's broadcast interview from Bill Elmshaven after he brought his U-boat back from that exploit. I want to quote a few phrases from it. They're rather significant as indicating just what happened. He says, "I ordered the torpedoes made ready and the U-boat prepared for an immediate turnabout. Sometime after releasing the torpedoes, I observed a huge water spot and heard a terrific detonation from the battleship which lay to the north of us. Flames spurted out. And later we saw two or three columns of water spout up. These were followed by blue and red-colored flames that arose from a ship anchored south of the first one upon which we had trained fire. Behind that ship," he continues, "lay another one with two funnels. It must have been the Repulse. Her bow was deep in the water. The first ship, which had only one funnel, meanwhile, had disappeared. A certain time after that, we sneaked through the barrier." Now, it's on the basis of that statement that the Germans have claimed that the Repulse was badly damaged. But there is no indication in the text of what Captain Preen said that he has any evidence that it was badly damaged. I cite that because we're going to get these conflicting claims constantly. And it's just as well that we should realize that both sides may be honest enough in what they claim, but that if they're not in a position to determine just what happened, well, perhaps we should always take such claims with a grain of salt. For example, the British do know what happened to the Repulse. The Germans do not. They're guessing. They didn't stay to find out. They had to get away in a hurry. And of course, the same thing is true with these repeated air raids. Therefore, I should think that, generally speaking, a good rule, up to the time that we definitely decide that someone is such a big liar that we can never trust him, up to that time, I should think a safe rule would be to take, perhaps most definitely, near the truth, that side which is in the best position to make a final report. In other words, if the raid is on Germany, then the Germans presumably know best actually what happened. If the raid is on Britain, then the British presumably know best what actually happened. Now, one interesting thing about this raid is that six torpedoes actually hit the one ship, and Lord Chatfield himself tells the House of Lords with true British sportsmanship today, "It was a remarkable exploit of professional skill and daring. I hope the Germans will be able to match that bit of sportsmanship with crediting the British with similar skill and daring if and when they show that they are capable of it." Well, in 6 weeks of war, 50,000 tons of capital ships have been lost by the British Navy. Now, the Germans make the claim that that covers something like 29% of the fleet, 60% of the home fleet, and, well, the British reply that the German propaganda machine is being used in a clumsy sort of way to smoke out the whereabouts of British ships, which Germany claims to have sunk. And, on the whole, it would seem impossible for the British to say that a ship had not been sunk when it actually had been sunk. Their own people would know that they were lying, and they would undermine all confidence in their statements if they endeavored to deny something so important as the sinking of a battleship. And, after all, you've got to take those things into account when you try to estimate which side is telling the truth in these contradictory claims. Now, Mr. Churchill told the House of Commons today that the Germans have lost some 20 submarines, and that's out of a total of only 60 that were ready when the war began. Now, that, of course, is serious. On the other hand, the loss of 174,000 tons of merchant shipping, which the British admit since the beginning of the war, that's also serious. But it isn't anywhere near one-third of Britain's merchant shipping. And generally speaking, except for the last few days, there was quite a period where the losses were negligible. Now, there were two more air raids today on Scapa Flow And in the first, the Iron Duke, Admiral Jellicoe's flagship, the Battle of Jutland, was damaged. Now, the British call it a retired battleship. It was used for training purposes. But the planes that did that damage got away. Then there was another raid, and this time there was no damage. One plane was shot down, and one, the British say, was probably disabled. But what we must conclude from all these events in Britain in the last 2-3 days is that the air arm is powerful, and the submarine arm is powerful. Certainly, for a submarine to be able to get by the British mines, the British nets, the British defense system that they've organized so carefully there, where their fleet is, well, that indicates that something is definitely wrong with their defensive system. Well, perhaps this is going to be a warning to them, and they'll be able to overcome that difficulty. The Germans made another heavy attack today on the Western Front. They threw between 50 and 75,000 men into the battle. It was another attack of major proportions. The French claimed that it was halted on a previously defined line. And the indications that we get from the French communiqués is that they've definitely decided not to risk too heavy losses in attempting to regain the ground that they won in front of the Maginot Line, that they are practically determined to give up that ground to fall back to their main defenses and then put the burden of the attack against their magnificent fortifications on the Germans. In the Netherlands, the Amsterdam Telegraph has a report of serious consultations between Hitler and his cabinet and his various military leaders. The idea is, according to this newspaper, to work out some sort of German consultation with Moscow and Rome. You'll remember that Hitler indicated that just as soon as his peace offensive failed, that Russia would be brought into the picture. Now, Moscow hasn't been brought into the picture, and it looks as though some sort of negotiation might be going out from Germany to try and bring Russia in and try and bring Mussolini in. After all, if Mussolini and Stalin combined to try and supplement Hitler's peace efforts, it's just possible that a peace movement could still get somewhere. We've had an interesting reply from the President of Soviet Russia to President Roosevelt's request that the Russian government should recognize the independence and sovereignty of Finland. And in order not to offend the isolationists in the United States, you remember that the United States government made no appeal. It was a personal note from the President of the United States to President Kalinin of Russia. And President Kalinin says that I consider it appropriate to remind you, Mr. President, that the state independence of the Finnish Republic was recognized by the free will of the Soviet government on December 31st, 1916, and that the sovereignty of Finland was guaranteed to it by the peace treaty of October 14th, 1920, between the Russian Socialist Federated Soviet Republic and Finland. By the above-mentioned acts of the Soviet government, the basic principles of the reciprocal relations between the Soviet Union and Finland were defined. The present negotiations between the Soviet government and the government of Finland are also being conducted in conformity with these principles. But we remember that Soviet Russia also had a similar treaty recognizing the sovereignty of Poland. What about that? Good night.
You have just heard H.V. Kaltenborn, Columbia's veteran news analyst, with his comments on the day's news. Mr. Kaltenborn spoke to you from the studios of WJR in Detroit. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.